Thank you for joining us for another lesson from God's Word. The West Huntsville Church of Christ at Providence is located at 1519 Old Monrovia Road, Northwest, Huntsville, Alabama, 35806. Anytime you're in the Huntsville area, we hope you'll stop in and be part of our worship. Sunday morning worship is at 9 o'clock, with Bible class immediately following. Sunday evening worship is at 5. Midweek Bible study is held Wednesdays at 7.
I realized years ago you should never start a class with an apology, so I'm not going to do that. I will start with a warning, however, because when David sent me a text message a couple weeks ago, and said, "Hey, Tom, I'm going to be out of town. Can you fill in?" I said, "Sure, absolutely." He said, "Teach on whatever you want." You should all be afraid. And so I did actually spend a fair amount of time thinking about that, because I haven't been to the Holy Land. I don't have any cool pictures from the Holy Land that I could put up there and talk about, right? The places I've been have been far more boring compared to that. And so I did actually kind of scratch my head and go, what in the world are we going to talk about? And how are we going to relate it in any way to something that's relevant to what we're already covering this quarter in this class? And so I landed on one. Let's see if you can follow my tangent here. Glenn actually kicked us off, if you recall. Glenn Colley did the first lesson. And in that first lesson, he spent his time basically establishing and showing that when we talk about the Holy Land, when we talk about modern Israel, I think it's important for Christians to understand that we're not talking about the Israel of the Old Testament. Okay? Ethnically, there may be some connections that try to get made. But we're not talking about the same thing. And I think that is an important thing for Christians to understand. So today, and I mentioned this briefly to Glenn after that class, there's two things that for me, maybe not correctly, but at least greatly informed how I think about and how I view the politics of that region today. And both of those are things that crossed my path 10 plus years ago. So I got some of the cobwebs off some of this, and I thought I'd share some highlights from some of that with you today, hopefully to add a little deeper context and add some of the history behind kind of that introduction that Glenn did when he started this, and why this region even today, at least from some of the last few hundred years, tends to be in the turmoil and the chaos that we see today. And those two different things that, at least for me, kind of changed how I viewed and thought about the Middle East. I mean, I'm old enough that I remember when Hezbollah was a new thing in the 80s and stuff was happening. Even then, it had already been going on for 30 or 40 years in a modern context. But those two things that crossed my path, the first one was a podcast that I don't recommend anybody listen to, because it's about 25 to 30 hours total of a series. It's called Fear and Loathing in New Jerusalem. And quite frankly, it's pretty graphic. I mean, when you're reading first-hand accounts of pogroms, of literally mobs storming through cities, raping and killing, some of those first-hand accounts are pretty graphic. But they're real events, and they really happened. And when that happens in a region, it changes people's lives. And so for me, that was the first time I had ever heard kind of a modern history of kind of what led up to Israel, what led up to a lot of things in the Middle East, presented in very much a non-theological way, presented in, to the extent possible, a historical context of here's what happened, here's events, here's how this side viewed it, here's how that side viewed it. So that was the first one. The second one was a little less obvious, and if I'd known it when I picked it up, I don't know if I would have picked it up, it would have been weird, but I was in 2nd and Charles right after it opened. I love me a good used book, because they're cheap. I'm cheap. And so I was wandering through there, and I stumbled across the official autobiography of T.E. Lawrence. Who knows who T.E. Lawrence is? Not Peter O'Toole, not a movie from the 1960s, which is horrible and only very loosely based on his work. Most people know T.E. Lawrence as Lawrence of Arabia. That's how he got marketed after World War I in the United States. But it was interesting. It was the authorized biography that was written in the 70s. One of his brothers actually found a guy and said, "Hey, would you write it?" At the time, the guy said no, He said, we're going to wait 10 years. I'll write it once all of his military records are completely declassified. Because in the late 60s, some of them still were. So it wasn't written until then. And it was interesting because this is a guy that was right in the middle of a lot of these events in the early 1900s in the Middle East. So this is not going to be one of those lessons that's going to answer all of the questions. I hope to give you things you have questions on that you can go research later, right? That you can go, oh, well, that was an interesting event. What really was that? And give you bits and pieces that you can go dig on. So loosely titled, I came up with three things we're going to talk about. Premillennialism, Zionism, and the Holy Land. They're the tragedy of the Holy Land. All right. So let's start by defining a few terms that I think are important. Glenn touched on this, but let's go through it again and maybe add a little deeper context to some of it. The first one is Zionism. We hear that one a lot. Modern political Zionism emerged in the late 19th century. And it was really crystallized around a couple of events. The first one was me and foreign languages. I don't read them words good. Theodor Herzl's Der Jägerstand was written in 1896. It was a foundational manifesto for modern political Zionism. And it was written in response to a lot of persistent European anti-Semitism. Herzl argued that Jewish emancipation had failed and that Jews constituted a nation without a state. His solution was to create a sovereign Jewish homeland secured through international law and diplomacy. Interestingly, this work is entirely secular and pragmatic. This is not a work that was made or based on biblical or Old Testament arguments. He wasn't arguing God promised us the land. He said, we're a nation wandering around without a home. We deserve a home. He framed the Jewish problem as political rather than religious and largely avoided biblical or messianic language. Herzl envisioned a modern, legal, European-style state as the means by which Jews could achieve safety, dignity, and a normal national life. About this same time, about a year later, the first Zionist Congress was held. It was convened by Theodor Herzl again, formally organized the Zionist movement, defined its political aim, being that the establishment of a secure, publicly recognized homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. The Congress created enduring institutions such as the World Zionist Organization and structured its leadership and fundraising mechanisms and transformed Zionism from an idea into a coordinated international movement. While deeply aware of Jewish historical connection to the land, the Congress approached the goal through diplomacy, law, and modern politics rather than biblical or messianic aims, reflecting Zionism's fundamentally secular and nationalist character. Why is this important? Why am I wasting our time talking about this? Tom, this is Bible class. Why are you reading me stuff off Wikipedia in a long, rambling, multi-threaded conversation with, well, Claude and a bunch of other AIs? It's simple. This never jumped out at me until probably 10, 15 years ago. I was sitting in a business meeting. I was sitting in the business meeting with the CEO of the organization I worked for, and we had some international visitors from the Middle East who were there to discuss a business proposal. And the words that came out of his mouth were, he who blessed Israel, I shall bless, and those who were against him, he started quoting Old Testament stuff. And the two guys I was meeting with from the nation of Israel looked as dumbfounded on their face as I did. Because Israel is a secular state. Yet I'm sitting there with an American who claims to be a Christian, denominational Christian, granted. But when he saw Israel, he viewed it only through the Old Testament. And that is where I personally believe Christians and Americans get it wrong. Oh, absolutely. Yes, that was the point. But it wasn't founded on God promised this land to Abraham. It was promised on, it was built on, we're a nation without a home. We need a home. Now, there's some reasons why they focused on Palestine. We'll get to that here in a minute. And some of them do, yes, go back to the Torah and make sense. But. So the roots were Jewish, European, and modern. They were shaped by, and this is important, this is the next thing we're going to talk about, persistent anti-Semitism, pogroms in Eastern Europe, the failure of Jewish emancipation, and the rise of nationalist thought. Crucially, early Zionism was largely secular. Many Zionists were indifferent or hostile to religious Judaism. The goal was safety, dignity, and statehood, not covenant renewal or temple restoration. Okay? Those were never stated goals. Zionism was not an attempt to become biblical Israel again, but to escape Europe's recurring violence. So now we have to, of necessity, talk about the pogroms in Eastern Europe in the 19th and early 20th centuries, and really even before that. You can go back to the 17th and 18th centuries and you can say things happened. So what am I talking about when I say pogrom? They were recurring waves of organized anti-Jewish violence spanning several centuries, intensifying, again, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, particularly within the Russian Empire and surrounding regions. These outbreaks, including murder, rape, looting, and the destruction of Jewish homes and synagogues, and were often tolerated, enabled, or inadequately suppressed by local authorities. Pogroms frequently erupted during periods of political instability or economic strain, with Jews scapegoated as outsiders, and the sustained insecurity created by these pogroms convinced many Jews that legal equity and assimilation had failed, prompting mass emigration and directly contributing to the rise of modern political Zionism as the search for physical safety, dignity, and national self-determination. The pogroms were caused by a volatile mix of religious anti-Semitism, economic scapegoating, and political instability. What are we talking about here? It's an awful lot of words. I had to start there to read it. Eastern Europe, the last 400 or 500 years. What did Jewish communities look like?
It was dispersed.
So you'd go to most cities, and in that city, what would you have, though? You'd have a group of people that tended to only interact with other people that within their community. Now, a lot of times they ended up in positions as bankers, as merchants. They didn't tend to be farmers. Why? They weren't allowed to own land in many of these countries and these communities. They were forced into what we would call the professional trades because they weren't allowed to own a farm. They weren't allowed to hold land. So it put them in these other positions. Now let's also think about what are we talking about over the last 400 or 500 years in Eastern Europe. People still do it today. Something bad happens, and what do? You blame the weird outsiders on the edge of town. They have to be the ones who caused this. All of a sudden, especially in Russia, there's upheaval. Tsar Alexander II gets murdered. There's assassination attempts. Things happen. What do? You blame those weird people on the edge of town that you don't understand, that only marry people within their community, that have all these weird customs. They don't dress like us. They don't shave like us. They kind of almost try to talk this weird language we don't understand. This is what's meant in what I read by religious anti-Semitism. They were scapegoated. At the same time, you have Eastern Orthodox and other flavors, for lack of a better term, or bents on Christianity that are still going, they're the same, because they're thinking a lot of this in those religious views. These are the same Jews that killed Christ. Okay? Ray.
After Catherine the Great set up the Vale of Settlement,
yeah.
There were a lot of Jewish uprisings,
mm-hmm.
murdering Christians, mobs of them. So a lot of these pogroms that you read about, you don't read about, you know, them as actually being reactionary.
Yeah.
And kind of like the news today.
Yeah. You know, yeah. These, just to repeat, these people are going to have a hard time hearing Ray. A lot of these programs were reactionary, right? So let's not act like this is all one-sided, that something happens here and then it goes the other way. There were plenty of back and forths with this community and that community blaming the other. But you did see this rising increase in violence. Yeah.
Refer to Jewish gatherings.
Yeah. Right, and they were there for a couple of reasons. One, they wanted to stay closer to people where they felt like they had some security, people that at least were like them, and at the same time, they were also forced into those areas, or told, no, you have to stay in this area. So it was a means of control. My point being, there's this history of violence that's been going on for years, and I want to point out that everything we're talking about here, we're talking pre-1920, okay? This is long before where people tend to go and they jump straight to the result and what happened in Germany in the 30s and in the 40s. I'm talking about a groundwork that was being laid for hundreds of years getting to that point. Okay? This is the part of history that usually gets glossed over. Yeah.
Another issue with Jewish people usury that they actually did loans whereas Christians couldn't do usury or loaning money, and that initially the Jewish people were loaning money, especially to royalty for wars. Wasn't that kind of part of the...
Yeah, I try to stay away from a lot of the... Okay, so this is just me. But because I don't understand it and don't know the history enough, I try to stay away from the conspiracy theory because Rothschild was involved in the Zionist movement. I try to stay away from the conspiracy theory that everybody hated them just because they loaned money to everybody and they were propping up...
The Balfour.
We're going to get there. So there's what my point is. There's a lot of stuff that happens that leads up to this. There's a lot of mistrust between these societies. A lot of what fed the early Zionist movement was the other piece here is I want you to realize there's lots of groups that all thought they were acting defensively and in their own self-interest. So what I've always thought was interesting, and the whole reason I started this, was I always thought there was this interesting connection, and I was curious if it was real or intentional or exactly what happened, between premillennialism and Zionism. Okay? So we started with Zionism. Remember, we're talking late 1800s is when this kind of formalized as a real movement. And gained what I would call political footing, became what I would think we would probably recognize today as a somewhat formal international political party, so to speak. So now let's talk a minute about premillennialism. So Christian premillennialism, dispensationalism, actually developed earlier than the formalized version of Zionism. Usually people focus on John Nelson Darby, who in the 1980s and 1930s popularized through prophecy conferences and later the Scofield Reference Bible, this idea of its defining convictions that include things like a future role for ethnic Israel, a literal connection between land and people, a distinction between Israel and the church, and an eschatological horizon that's yet unfilled. So this idea of how they're interpreting a few choice events involving the end times or the end of the world specifically to kind of fit this. So by the time Zionism became a political force, premillennial theology was already established. So let's talk a little bit about what that establishment or some scriptural references here for kind of what this was and what Darby's views were. So the core context is kind of summed up in Revelation 21 through 6. where we see six references in a row to 1,000 years during which Christ reigns and Satan is bound. And in the premillennial reading of this text, it's taken chronologically after Revelation 19, which talks about Christ's return, and interpreted quite literally, not symbolically. And this kind of forms the backbone of the claim that Christ must return before this millennial dispensation that they interpret this as discussing. There are some people that will try to claim this has already always been the view, and they'll try to go back and look at folks like Irenaeus, who, you know, was a very early figure in Christianity, and they'll try to point to some things that have been written there. However, I think what we see there is different from what Darby was stating. I think if you look at the references that people try to make about that first, you know, maybe 400-year, 300-year period of the church and premillennialism already being established, what you're really seeing there is the holdover belief of what the Jews were expecting of the earthly kingdom. I'm not saying these aren't unrelated. I'm just saying I think they're different. And by the time you get to Darby, you're talking about something that's quite a bit different. Also, if this was really the correct view, as Darby would claim, as he would try to reach back to some of those, well, it disappeared for 1,400 years, and nobody really talked about it until all of a sudden he magically brought it back and said, hey, we're all doing this wrong. So the fact that there wasn't really even for this long period discussion around it, it was a fairly dramatic shift in interpretation. So the second real point about this is Christ's return before the kingdom is the argument. They'll go to places like Acts 1, 6, and 7. The disciples asked about restoring the kingdom of Israel. Matthew 19, 28, Jesus speaks of a future renewal of all things. There's some Old Testament passages that get pulled out too. But basically, Darby concludes that Israel's kingdom promises were not the church, that it was a physical kingdom that would be on earth, and that they remained future, and that they remained earthly, and that Christ must return first to establish them. It also, premillennialism also tends to view Israel and the church as, I think they would be there, different identities, different promises, different prophetic destinies. Some of this is not as far off base as others. The other key piece is that literal fulfillment of the land promise. Much like many of the passages that Cody used this morning, right, when we talk about the cross, they'll go back to the similar promises that were made at the same time and point forward to this unconditional land promise to Abraham. Even some of Ezekiel 36 and 37 talking about a national restoration imagery as something that has yet to come and will come that's part of this. And these promises were never revoked or transferred, therefore they have to be something that's still going to come. He says that the fulfillment must be historical and geographic, not merely spiritual. It's basically the argument. It also has this weird, I'm not sure how you get there, this whole idea of the church age being almost this parenthetical note that kind of happens. This is back to that whole argument of Jesus tried to establish the earthly kingdom, the Jews rejected him, therefore the church is like this stopgap that was put in place that will just kind of like be a steward until Christ returns and then the real kingdom will take place again. We could look at these, we could spend a lot of weeks looking at these. I personally think there's a lot of mental gymnastics that one has to try to go through to take what are fairly plain teachings and twist them into something else to pick a predetermined outcome rather than what's actually being said. I find this usually to be the case when I see weird references being made between, you know, Daniel and Romans. I mean, that's you're trying to, in my opinion, you're trying to make some stretches. But basically, it boils down to Darby believing that Israel's prophetic clock paused after rejecting Christ, right? So instead of the idea of the kingdom being established, even though Jesus told them, you're going to see it come with power in your lifetime, some of you standing here, No, it was put on pause. And the church exists as a divinely intended interlude, so to speak, in between the two. You'll also see a lot about the pre-tribulation rapture. Best I could tell, this doctrine emerged almost entirely with Darby. And it's something that you certainly don't see, like I spoke of those early church writers that would still hold on to some of those Jewish beliefs or desires of an earthly kingdom. This is something that kind of showed up new with him. He tries to use some text out of 1 Thessalonians. Believers are caught up. He tries to claim that that's a rapture rather than a fairly clear description of the end times. And then, as one could imagine, an awful lot of passages hand-plicked out of Revelation to suit the purpose. The idea being, in Darby's view, that Christ comes for his saints and then later with his saints and separates the church from the tribulation described. The last point that I found here tried to describe why Darby rejected some of the current interpretations. Although I'll be honest, I found most of those a little weak, and I always feel like I'm on dangerous ground if I'm trying to tell you why someone else believes something. If they clearly tell me what they believe, that's one thing. But when I start trying to read their mind, I feel like I'm on pretty shaky soil. So I'll be honest, I was going to skip some of that. But really, he does this weird reframing of everything. He does try to preserve in all of these gyrations biblical authority, historical honesty, and Christian humility. But he does it in a way that is a little unique. So I think the best way to summarize it would be this. So premillennialism draws, especially from Revelation 20, the Old Testament land promise and New Testament distinctions between Israel and the church. And Darby systematized these texts into what he believed to be a coherent framework by reading prophecy literally, separating Israel and the church, and proposing a future restoration of Israel following a pre-tribulation rapture. So the point of all that being, you had this idea floating around that was not new. It had been around for a while. It was making the, if you will, denominational rounds at the time. And then you suddenly have Zionism coming on the scene as a more formalized, established political movement. So did premillennialism create Zionism? No, right? It's not, there's no evidence of that. There's no real reason, you know, to think such. However, if you look at the end aims of the two, right, I think it's important to realize that the premillennialism predated, and Christian restoration long predated Zionism. Some of the ideas that Darby was starting to then kind of change with, I mean, you can trace some of that all the way back to the English Puritans. You can absolutely see it in 18th and 19th century evangelicals. British leaders who viewed history through a biblical interpretation or almost, in some cases, I think I'd use the word imagination more than interpretation. So it created this cultural backdrop that when Zionism was dropped in, it suddenly seemed plausible, especially in Britain, all right? So I think that's important to remember. Now, what is also key here is that did Zionism reinforce premillennialism? I think there's a pretty strong historical argument for that that says, yes. If I walk up and say, hey, I want you to support my movement, and you say something that I think is complete nonsense, but it still ultimately results in you're going to support my movement, I'm willing to go, sure, so you're on board? Great, let's go make it happen, right? And I think that's the example I would use of what happened here. One did not create the other, but I think there's some pretty strong and compelling evidence, especially when you start realizing that history is created by humans. And I think there are absolutely figures along the way who believed this, and for their own beliefs, while it may not be an entire political party or everybody, I think there were some very specific people along the way that were premillennialists that went, oh yes, and they saw this as being evidence of what they'd already believed, and hey, now they can even help move it along. Yeah.
Marketing of the word, you know, if you go to Israel, and there are all kinds of other places there, people say, oh, we make this happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's all over.
Yeah.
Well, so.
Yeah, I think to your point, it's like David was talking about last week, right? Everywhere that he goes over there, there's people, well, we think this happened here, right? And for $5, we'll let you come see it, right? Do those people think that actually happened there? I don't think they care if it actually happened there. It's how they're making a living, right? And so if you want to come see it, hey, I've got some land in Athens, and I'm pretty sure a bunch of Civil War soldiers marched over it. So if you want to come see it, I'll show you the pasture that they marched over. It's $12.95 a piece, and it's a one-hour tour, and I'll talk the whole time, right? And I think there's probably was a bit of that. But here we have a case where they absolutely, this movement, found sympathetic ears in Christians that had been hearing this premillennial idea and saw events that were happening as confirmation of this view of what they believed. And I think it's the reason they were often able to get support that otherwise would not have made sense politically. There's some people that you see taking risks and going out on limbs that just don't make... Why would you take the risk? Why would you even bother? Why would you care? And so that's my point, in that they are, I believe, a bit intertwined. So the connection definitely runs in the opposite direction more directly. You also have to realize that at this time, settlement in that region started. Okay? So you did have lots of people. Again, they were looking for safety and trying to get out of Europe, where they were being actively persecuted. Hey, let's move. There were people that were already moving to the area of Palestine. So this became a bit of a reinforcing function to the level of interpretation, not really control of what was happening. So, premillennialism did not engineer Zionism, but Zionism strengthened premillennial confidence for an awful lot of people. I think another thing that we need to remember, because it's easy to forget in history, especially when you look at maps, because what maps don't show on you is people living there, right? So this was not a land that was empty. And this is the part where, the reason why I mentioned T.E. Lawrence, because this was the part that in my mind, I'd always made the mistake of reading the history book and like, it's desert. There's nothing there. This is desert. A couple little cities. And that was definitely not the case. And that's one of the things I actually kind of liked about the podcast that I mentioned, was it doesn't treat the population, the people that are already there, as an afterthought. It points out that, hey, there have been people living there in these lands for centuries. And they were very different in a lot of ways from European societies. Europe had kind of gone down one road, and the Middle East had gone down a bit of a different one. In Europe, you very much had, well, I mean, especially in Britain, I mean, we're talking British society. I mean, we put on our coats and jackets for tea in the afternoon, and it's a very different than a Bedouin society that's still named after the people who live there, right? The people of Edom were Edomites. The people from different lands were the people from those lands. It's a different culture experience that was rooted in clan, honor, land, and community, which was a little different than what was going on in the same time period in Europe, which was very much a European nationalist viewpoint, right? I'm a Brit, I'm a German, I'm from France, I'm Italian. And the people there very much experienced and saw Zionism as a displacement and a threat. Specifically, because you have to remember, we're talking about people for whom land was not simply property. It was identity. Right? That's something that we forget. I live in a very unique place because I happen to live on a piece of property that's been in the family for 102 years now, right? Most Americans don't. I didn't grow up on it. I didn't grow up anywhere near it, but I live on it now. And if you ask me, where are you from, or where you live, oh, I proudly live on the Looney Farm, because my great-uncle's grandfather that bought it, his last name was Looney. I live on Looney Road. The city can call it Lindsay Lane all they want, but I live on Looney Road on the Looney Farm, right? Most people don't have that, right? They're born in one place. They move to another. They move around. They don't have the sense of identity. But the people that were already in Palestine had been there in some ways for centuries and were identified by that land. Yeah, comment?
And I think for at least the people that I know that, you know, it's kind of like pointy and all over. And a lot of the people that are the millennials use the scope of the Bible.
Yeah.
So it was common for them to, well, the Bible says it. So
yep. I think that's
for America, that was the biggest influencer.
And I think it's important to realize that you have three or four parties here involved, that every one of them, none of them are really acting with malice. They're acting out of what they believe to be in their own defense and in their best interest. Premillennialists aren't intentionally doing something because they know it's false and they want to go down some weird road. They genuinely believe what they believe. The Zionists were genuinely looking for a place where they felt like they could feel safe, right? So I think it's important when you look at historical events, it's easy to do the Snidely Whiplash thing and start twisting, you know, one side's twisting their mustache and tying people to train tracks and the other side's driving the train, right? I mean, that's not always the case. You have a bunch of people that are mutually acting in what they believe to be their best interest, right? And that's part of what happened here. So next, I think we should talk about Britain. Britain did some things that gave them a fatal role in this whole thing. They made incompatible promises to Jews and Arabs in the region, especially after and during World War I. They governed ancient societies with modern bureaucratic tools. That is very much true in the Middle East. When you're dealing with Bedouins, when you're dealing with tribal communities that still have a person who's in charge who sits in a tent. I didn't appreciate this until I went to Papua New Guinea, right, where they still live under tribal law. They told a crazy story about a riot that broke out at the mine, and a dude whose job was to scrub the toilets every day. I mean, we're talking a bunch of crazed people that are hopped up on this local plant, this or narcotic, are coming down, and they're about to storm the big locked-in area where all the administrators are. And this dude, who nobody knew who he was at the mine, they had hired him, and he was a janitor. He scrubbed toilets all day, walked out in front of the gate and stood there. All the guys stopped. They stood there dumbfounded for a couple minutes, and they dispersed and went home. The people that ran the mine are like, what in the world just happened? Yeah, he was a local tribal chief. If they'd laid a hand on him, it would have been tribal war. And there would have been hundreds dead, and it would have had nothing to do with the folks that were there running the mine, that were the, as they viewed them, crazy folks out of Australia that were there up in the mines digging for the yellow rock, right? Britain didn't appreciate those roles in these cultures, because they saw the guy that was important was the dude that was dressed nice, right? They had a very different idea of how the societies would run. So all of this led up and moved through what became known as the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which kind of illustrates the problem here. The Balfour Declaration was a British wartime statement supporting a Jewish national home in Palestine, while simultaneously promising to protect Arab rights. It used intentionally vague commitments that advanced Zionist hopes, but created unresolved tensions that still shape the region to this day. It was inspired by kind of a humanitarian sympathy, a biblical imagination, founded in some premillennialism, and driven by wartime strategy more than anything. And it was also blind to the social cost on the ground. And that was the other thing, is you have people who are 1,000 miles away in Britain and in France, making promises and all these things about what's going to happen in the Middle East, which is what leads into what I found, which was the interesting tie-in with T.E. Lawrence. So Lawrence is an interesting figure. He is one of those people that had a very unique personal view into things like what the Balfour Declaration was doing on the ground, what it caused to happen in these communities and in this area. He had that view because he was an archaeologist. Pre-World War I, this whole area was what? What was this area? Pre-World War I, Ian? The Ottoman Empire. That's right. So he's there as an archaeologist from a British museum living in these communities. He spoke Arabic and several dialects of it. And he's there working, and they're excavating, I think it was Hittite ruins. He's an academic. And he had grown, after living in this community for years, to have a deep respect for the Arab culture and the honor codes under which it operate, and the understanding of tribal politics. I'm told that later on, he became one of those people that he would dress like the Lotus, he could get along, he knew he would eat the same food, he knew all the same customs, he could sit in a tent with Arab royalty, and no one knew that he wasn't a European until they looked him in the eyes, because he had blue eyes. Even when he spoke, they couldn't distinguish him. So the important thing here is you have to realize that Lawrence did not view the Arabs abstractly like the politicians back in London did. These were his friends. These were people he knew. That was one of the shocking things for me. Americans need to travel more. Because you know what happened when I got to Papua New Guinea and I was dealing with this world culture? I realized, hey, these are still people. Sometimes we forget that when we think about people in foreign places. World War I breaks out. He gets drafted. He's been to college. He's studying from universities at Oxford. He's doing archaeology, so he becomes an officer in Cairo in a British intelligence unit. And he spent basically 2 or 3 years starting at the outbreak of the war. He was assigned to the British Arab Bureau in Cairo. As you can imagine, he had a lot of skills that they needed. The Brits were pretty desperate at this point. The Hussein McMahon correspondence, in which Britain promised Arab independence in exchange for a revolt against the Ottomans. Lawrence was the guy who was carrying these messages. He was sneaking into the Gulf of Aqaba, to the port at Aqaba. He was the one who was carrying messages to the sheriff in Mecca, who was helping negotiate with the Arabs. Hey, we want you guys to revolt against the Ottomans. He was directly involved in trying to get these huge societies of Bedouins with horses and camels to fight against an army with trains and machine guns. Right. The Ottomans were aligned with the Kaiser. He ended up becoming a liaison to Emir Faisal in the Arab Revolt from 16 through 18. He was sent to work directly with Emir Faisal. He helped organize the guerrillas. He was actively involved. He even did some crazy stuff, like some of the first use of airplanes in wartime, which he was using for mapping and scouting of troops. So the moral heart of Lawrence's tragedy directly intersects with later Zionist and imperial claims. Somewhere around 1916, 1917, he became aware of Britain's secret agreements with France, the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916, secretly dividing Arab lands between Britain and France, even though they had been promised independence. The emerging plans that would later culminate in the Balfour Declarations. From this point forward, Lawrence knew that the British promise to the Arabs were already compromised, and that he was encouraging men to fight for a future that likely would never exist. This knowledge haunted him and appeared repeatedly in his later writings. Basically, it boils down to this. Through his efforts, it was a huge military victory, but a political disaster for the Arabs. So much so that he had been promoted all the way to colonel. He then hid in disgrace and spent the rest of his military career hiding as airmanshaw in the newly formed Air Corps, where he had an enlisted rank, and basically hid, doing the job of a clerk during the day. I don't know if it's true, but I read one account that when he was finally called before the king, who wanted to honor him for all of his great service during World War I, the king was appalled because every time he would pin a ribbon on him, he would go over to the tray to pick up the next medal to put on Lawrence. He'd come back, and the medal he just pinned on him was gone. Because as fast as the king would put him on, he would take him off and put him in his pocket, because he felt like he had betrayed people that he was asked to go negotiate in good faith for. Interestingly enough, later on through the Paris conference and some other stuff that happened, we did see the establishment of Faisal. I mentioned he was the emir to Faisal. Faisal became the king of... No. Well, Faisal was in Saudi Arabia, but then even he was good friends with... Oh, I just forgot his name. King in Baghdad. It wasn't Faisal, but basically, if you want to connect this to modern times, the guys that the little bit of redemption Lawrence thought he finally had ended up being the establishment of Iraq and the kings in Iraq who Saddam Hussein then overthrew his son. There's a lot that goes on in these areas and a lot of interesting overlaps even with our modern history. And I really feel like it's one of those things where hopefully I've at least thrown enough words out there that you'll be interested in, that you'll want to go research, because you can't have a rational discussion about these areas today without understanding what's the person you're talking to actually believe and what lens are they using to look at this. And you have to take the time to understand things happen for a reason, because that's what both sides believe. So anyway, I appreciate your attention, and good news, I'm not teaching next week.
We hope you have enjoyed this lesson from God's Word. If you would like to continue your study of New Testament Christianity, please send your name and address to World Bible School, West Huntsville Church of Christ, 1519 Old Monrovia Road, Northwest, Huntsville, Alabama, 35806. Or if you prefer, send your name and address by email to wbs@westhuntsville.org.